You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Suzanne Anker. Suzanne, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So, Suzanne, I want to talk about what's happening in your studio now, and then we'll perhaps explain to some of the listeners, you know, if it's not apparent, what it means that you're so involved with bio art and the books you've written on that, and how it filters into the classes that you're involved in as well. But to begin with, what are you working on in your studio at the moment?
Well, I'm continuing a series of work that I've started over the last year and a half or so, called Vanitas in a Petri Dish, as a kind of way to bring together art biology and art history. And, you know, the Petri dish is a cultural icon now. Everyone knows what a Petri dish is, and it's used as a metaphor as well to talk about things that are brewing but can't be seen yet. So what I've done and what I'm continuing to do is to bring together things from the animal, vegetable, and mineral world as a kind of reference to synthetic biology, and put them in the dish and then photograph them from the top down. The second part of that series of work is called remote sensing, in which I take the photograph of Vanitas in a Petri dish and convert it into a three-dimensional program and then print it out as a rapid prototype sculpture. And to my surprise, what became evident was the fact that when you take the two-dimensional image and put it in three dimensions, it looks as if it's a landscape. So hence the name remote sensing, which is a form of satellite data that is used for sort of exploring spaces that are either too toxic in the environment or spaces that are war-torn. And what I found interesting and why I'm continuing this is the fact that you can, again, intersect these genres in art history and update them to the 21st century.
So let's talk a little bit about exactly how you build the Vanitas in a Petri dish. What are you putting in that Petri dish that's being photographed, and are those elements living, growing, changing at all?
Well, they're mostly dead. Like dead insects or very slow-moving objects like rocks or flower petals or seeds or pieces of metal or anything that's part of the image bank in the world. Because, you know, the Vanitas idea, which comes out of 17th, 18th, and 19th century, is a way in which one takes pause about one's mortality in the life cycle. And what had happened is that many people were sort of devoting themselves to more of a materialistic understanding of the world as opposed to one that was more spiritual. So, you know, what we have here now is the use of the Petri dish as a signifier for the way science, and particularly the biological sciences, have become the reigning paradigm in not only science, but also in cultural awareness. So I think that, you know, when one looks at the whole life cycle, one needs to take great pause because it's a continuous process that brings to the fore the way in which nature is always being altered and always in flux.
And so when you're assembling these things, I mean, it's true, the Vanitas often I think of as a skull and in the still life, and this very kind of, you know, sobering notion that we are mortal. In what you put in the dish there, these different matters, this kind of landscape as it becomes when it's photographed, do you feel it has that, it communicates that kind of a notion of facing our mortality?
I think it does. You know, I think that there's an edge to the work, that it's not just, you know, pretty little pictures, but has, you know, some kind of jolting attitude about it as well. Some of the pieces were just recently commissioned by the World Science Festival in Australia, and they were presented as light boxes up on a building in Brisbane, and but they were received very well. And there's always a little horror in most of my work, but there's also the other flip side, which is the kind of beauty that acts as a signaling device. So people come and look, and then they begin to think about what they're looking at.
And why horror? I mean, that's an interesting word. Is it this notion of kind of a Frankenstein paradigm that you're playing with life, or what is the horror?
I think part of it is Frankenstein narrative, because that's still going on. That's the same narrative, Mary Shelley's narrative, that we're still living under. But also the idea of mortality, the idea that everyone has an expiration date, and how that relates to the world at large. You know, now that we are seeing so much ecological destruction and extinction of species, et cetera, that, you know, life is very, very fragile in one sense. In another sense, it's resilient, but it's that duality that is of critical importance to me, so it has to have some kind of edge to it.
And in this field of bioart, which I know you've incorporated into your programming at SVA, maybe we can talk a little bit about that in this context, because this is your medium, but it's also a medium that you're sharing with students and obviously different scientific organizations who are interested, as in the commission you just mentioned. How does it fit into a new visual art practice?
It's a very interesting concept, and one that's very hard to get your mind around. I know that we're the first bioart laboratory in a fine arts department in an art school in the United States. And there are several others that are now to follow, such as the Chicago Art Institute and also the program up at Buffalo. So this is becoming sort of something that fits in well with the technological apparatus of our day, since so much of biology is now technology. And if we go back to the history of technology and we kind of see how living matter has been decoded essentially into sequences, then it makes sense for students to work with biology in the same way they would work with video art or new media or even photography. This is, I think, an issue which is more prevalent in Europe than it is here. I think in Europe and in Australia there are a lot more practitioners that are going on around this. And so I think that this is the cutting edge, really, of working with the tools of science to make art, because this is not a scientific laboratory. It is about a place where the imagination can trump the scientific method, which you cannot do in a science laboratory.
That's very interesting. And, you know, a while ago I interviewed Joe Davis, who, would you consider him someone who's making bio-art and kind of...
Yes,
in this
I know Joe,
well?
And he's a pretty extraordinary character. I see Joe as an inventor. I see him as a bio-artist, but I think his real talents are in inventions, because he, you know, has this great understanding of materials and of processes, and is able to really explore what has not been explored before.
It seems to be an interesting relationship between sciences and the arts. I mean, as you explain, I have a student's relationship to this, and I think of when I interviewed Joe, I went up to MIT and Harvard and began talking with him, the heads of some of those departments, asking them, well, what's the role of someone like Joe here, and why isn't there more like that? And part of the answer I got was that there's no money for it, and that Joe's working in an environment where students are experimenting in the lab, but they're also being watched by the university and the funders of the university, because inventions and discoveries and methods of working could potentially be monetized and used by the powers that support these kind of institutions. And thus Joe felt kind of difficult to work with on one hand, because he doesn't want his work monetized or taken by these guys, and they don't know how to quantify what he's doing anyway. What's the future of that? Where would we like to see that go?
Well, I think you raise a very good point, because we had entered a competition in synthetic biology in the art and design track in October. It was called iGEM, and over 300 schools participated in it in different tracks. We happen to have won the art and design track, as well as honorable mentions in numbers of other categories, like best social practices, best presentation, best public outreach, etc. And I think that our project was called Soiled, and we went around and tested the soil of 61 samples in urban gardens in the five boroughs in New York.
And then let me just interrupt for a moment. You went around with your students and collected all these samples.
Yes, this was a student project. And, and that we ended up designing a device that could really test the nutrients in soils. We designed a prototype that is very, very less toxic than how soil is usually tested. We haven't brought that device to market, but basically what you're raising here in terms of intellectual property is a good one, should we go down and proceed along those lines. And we're working on a number of other projects like that that have the potential of being marketed. So that is still an unknown question.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That must be a growing area, because I don't know a lot about how the departments work, but if I understand correctly, at Yale and other institutions where there are science departments, there's a whole group of people in those departments that are just figuring out how to monetize and bring to market ideas that students are coming up with at this school, as well as
Absolutely.
Faculty.
Absolutely. And there's been many cases of you know, of theft, of intellectual theft, et cetera.
So this
is a whole new area, and I think that it's very exciting to think in these terms, because many projects that go on in the art world are all solution and no problem. So basically, by shifting this to a newer kind of paradigm, other kinds of questions come to the fore, which are really critical for what it means to be a human being in the 21st century in a global world.
And what are some of those questions? I mean, we're talking about, big notions, I suppose, about what it means to be using materials like this. But are some of the questions raised, do you mean ethical questions
Ethical questions are definitely ethical questions, such as, you know, if we can do something, should we do it? This was a sort of big debate around cloning, et cetera, or recombinant DNA earlier in the 70s. New issues, I think, also have to do with in vitro fertilization, the way in which embryos are now being manipulated. Another aspect of this also has to do with new sources of proteins that eliminate the animal from the equation, where you can perhaps devise, this is another one of our projects, a tomato that has the same nutrient value as a hamburger, but there's no hamburger.
Yeah, that's so fascinating and interesting.
And a lot of gardening, a lot of urban food production is moving indoors because of climate change and the different kinds of ways that species are becoming extinct. So these are all really interesting questions. You know, when you ask someone what kind of food they eat, they don't really want to think about it, because so much of the food is industrialized that if they really sat down and think about it, they may not have anything to eat anymore.
Well, right. I know my wife was saying to me just yesterday over barbecue, she said, is that, is the corn organic? I said, no. She said, well, then it's probably, genetically modified. I said, well, actually, I think all corn is genetically modified. I don't think it's possible to get it on. It is, right? There's no such thing.
It is. Well, if not all, then 98%,
Right. Anything we buy in the market, certainly.
Yeah. And all popcorn, we've done some GMO testing in our BioArt lab, too, and found quite a few things that are GMOs. We also invited Monsanto to come and give a talk in our lab. Now, that was a very curious experience, because most artists or sort of more radical thinkers wouldn't even let them in the door. But our thought was that let's see what is going on and how they position themselves in dialogue. This is maybe an ongoing dialogue with them, and I'm interested in understanding what these agro businesses are about, because whoever keeps the seeds controls the world.
Right. Though, is the issue different than it is popularized, though? I mean, we talk about GMOs being such a potential problem, and certainly the idea of who owns the seeds is one aspect of it. But when you talk about a tomato that has the nutrients of a hamburger, that's obviously a genetically modified tomato,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And this would be a tomato that would be perfectly healthy to eat, or how do you view that whole idea of eating genetically?
Well, we'd have to test it all, but basically I don't want to paint all GMOs with the same brush or the same kind of corporate investment strategies in it. I think that that GMOs in and of itself have made some outstanding contributions to medicine in terms of pharmaceuticals. So, you know, I think that this is a question that, again, needs to be parsed, so we just don't go on saying, oh, all GMOs are bad and we don't want them here. We need to dissect this question.
I like that. It's very interesting, a very interesting topic, and it's exciting what's happening at SVA with this department. And so before we
close, I hope you would come visit us. I think you would enjoy coming down, maybe sort of talk about your radio program also.
I'd love that. Let's talk for just the last question. Is there, and this can be off topic really, is there a book that you're reading now? There'll be links to both of the books that you've written in here, but is there a book that you're reading now that it could be, you know, anything from a novel to something about, you know, bio technology, but is there anything you're reading now that you'd want to share with us?
Well, that's a very good question, because I'm always reading something. There's a very good book called Culturing Life, and it is by Hannah Landecker, and it is asks the questions how cells become technologies. So we're looking at cells not as we did in the 19th or 20th century, but we're looking at them as having a technological base. So I highly recommend this book.
Suzanne, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. I want to thank you for spending this time with me today.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.